Think about the last time you checked your bank account, or maybe the last time you paid your rent, or I don't know, caught a headline about the national debt and just felt that familiar, really heavy knot of anxiety in your stomach.
Yeah, that pit in your stomach feeling, we all know it.
Right. Because we all operate under this set of fundamental assumptions about what money is, how debt works, what we can actually afford as a society. But what if the way we think about all those things is just completely backward?
I mean, it is a huge question. What if the financial operating system we rely on is actually programmed, like at a structural level, to consume the very world it's supposed to sustain?
Exactly. And that realization is exactly what we're exploring today.
Welcome to our deep dive. We've got a massive stack of research today centered around honestly, a truly paradigm-shifting academic white paper. It's called Life Coherent Financing: Money, Debt, Credit, and the Drift from Life Service to Life Extraction. And that's by Dr. Bechara Sailey. Yeah, and we're also pulling in supporting context from economic anthropologists, modern monetary theorists, legal scholars, because to even ask that question requires a really profound shift in perspective.
For sure. Our mission here is to just completely dismantle the idea that finance is this passive backdrop to the real economy. Like, it's just a giant objective calculation.
Because we are so conditioned to view it that way. We treat finance as a neutral tool for measuring value, governed by, mathematical laws like physics.
But it's not physics. Instead, we're looking at finance as this civilizational grammar. It's a rule book that literally decides which futures get to exist and which ones don't.
Exactly. And when you examine the mechanisms closely, you realize that calculator isn't just measuring the world, it's actively making moral and physical decisions about who gets to thrive, what gets built, and, well, what gets destroyed.
So to navigate all of this, Dr. Sinhili poses a core diagnostic question early in the paper, and it's a lens we'll use to evaluate everything we discuss today.
Yeah, it's a great anchor. The question is basically, does our financial system help living systems flourish, or does it convert life into collateral for self-expanding claims?
Put simply, is money serving life or is life serving money? The best way I can frame this for you, the listener, is to imagine we are looking at the source code, the fundamental operating system of civilization itself. We're going to find out why this system keeps crashing the real economy and how we might actually reprogram it.
Right. But to understand how the operating system is broken today, we first have to understand how it was originally built, which means unlearning the biggest myth in economics.
Oh, the barter myth. We all know the standard Adam Smith textbook Origin of Money, the whole double coincidence of wants problem.
Yeah, the story where we supposedly spent centuries awkwardly trying to like trade chickens for shoes until someone finally invented coins to act as a neutral medium of
Right,
exchange.
and it's such a pervasive story. I mean, it makes intuitive sense.
It does. It appears in almost every introductory economics textbook. But as anthropologists like David Graeber have extensively documented, it is, well, it's completely historically inaccurate.
Wait, really? Like totally made up.
Pretty much, yeah. The historical and archaeological record shows that societies did not transition from barter to money and then to credit. The sequence is actually the exact
The
reverse.
reverse. So credit came first.
Exactly. Money didn't start as a neutral medium of exchange among isolated strangers swapping commodities. It started as a ledger. It was a system of social memory, of obligation and trust within tightly knit communities.
So if I needed shoes in an ancient agrarian community, I wouldn't have to wander around looking for a cobbler who happened to want my chickens right that second.
No, not at all. The cobbler would just give you the shoes, and the community would remember that you owed him.
Okay, so the community just kept a tally.
Yeah, sometimes literally on clay tablets or wooden tally sticks, but often just as a shared social memory. If you look at the credit theory of money, developed by people like A. Mitchell Innes, or the state theory of money by Georg Friedrich Knapp, they emphasize that money at its genesis is essentially a relation.
A relation. Not a thing.
Right, not a physical thing with intrinsic value. It is a way of quantifying and remembering who owes what to whom, and critically, what everyone owes to the broader community or the public authority.
So it was shaped by things like tribute or the need to provision temples, taxation, religious ritual.
Yes, money is fundamentally a token of an obligation. It's a measure embedded entirely within a web of human relationships.
But I mean, if money is fundamentally just a social relationship and a ledger of trust, why does it feel like this cold, autonomous force today? Because I can tell you, it does not feel like a warm community relationship when my mortgage payment is due.
Oh, absolutely not.
Or when my credit card interest hits. It feels like an unyielding mathematical law.
Well, that shift from a social relation to a cold, autonomous force is driven by a process we call abstraction.
Abstraction.
How does that work?
So as human societies grew larger and more complex, moving from small villages to massive empires and global trading networks, those intimate face-to-face obligations had to be quantified. They had to become transferable. They had to become impersonal.
Right, because you can't rely on neighborhood trust if you're trading with someone three towns over.
Exactly. Now, we have to acknowledge that abstraction is absolutely necessary for large-scale coordination. You cannot run a global supply chain or, you know, build a semiconductor factory or fund a massive public works project relying purely on knowing a guy. You need a system that allows absolute strangers on opposite sides of the planet to cooperate reliably.
So you need a standardized unit that doesn't care if I know the person I'm transacting with. The abstraction makes the scale possible.
It does. But here's the structural danger that the paper highlights. As obligations become increasingly abstract, transferable, and legally enforceable, they completely detach from the social knowledge that originally constrained them.
Meaning what exactly?
Meaning, in a localized, relationship-based system, a creditor knows the debtor. If a farmer's crop fails because of a drought, or if a tradesman suffers a death in the family, the debt is interpreted within a human context.
I see. There's leeway.
Right. There is forbearance because the creditor realizes that destroying the debtor destroys the community fabric. But in modern finance, the abstraction is total. A collateralized debt obligation or a mortgage-backed security traded in New York doesn't see the family living in the house in Ohio.
It's just a number on a spreadsheet.
Exactly. The debt remains strictly enforceable even when the human relationship completely disappears. The abstraction becomes what Saley calls life blind.
Wow. Life blind. So the abstraction allows the scale, but it strips away the context. The system is no longer capable of forgetting or forgiving, even if enforcing the spreadsheet means a family loses their home.
Right.
And I imagine that detachment becomes truly dangerous when you add the element of time into the equation. Specifically, the math of compound interest.
Oh, yes. The temporal trap. This is huge. Dr. Saheli spends significant time analyzing the temporal asymmetry of compound interest.
Temporal asymmetry. Break that down for us.
So it's a crucial concept. A financial claim, once abstracted and set into a contract, can grow exponentially and automatically. It just requires the mathematical ticking of a clock. But real-life human bodies, agricultural crops, complex ecosystems cannot grow infinitely or exponentially.
Right. A human being gets tired. Soil gets depleted and requires fallow periods. A forest takes decades to regrow.
Exactly.
Like a biological mismatch. You have a mathematical claim demanding exponential growth, but the physical world it relies on is constrained by thermodynamics and biology. Wait. It's like a parasite.
A parasite, that's a strong word, but very fitting.
If a biological parasite demands more energy than the host organism can physically produce, enforcing that demand doesn't make the host work harder. It just kills the host.
That is a very accurate biological analogy. If the financial claim grows faster than the living capacity required to pay it, the debt begins to consume the underlying life ground. And what is fascinating from a historical perspective is that ancient civilizations actually understood this temporal asymmetry much better than our modern financial institutions do.
Wait, really? The ancients understood finance better than Wall Street?
In this specific regard, yes. The economic historian Michael Hudson has done brilliant work analyzing ancient agrarian societies, particularly in Mesopotamia. These civilizations recognized very clearly that mathematical debts would inevitably outgrow the society's physical capacity to pay them.
Because the interest on the grain loans compounded faster than the wheat could physically grow in the fields.
Exactly. And the ancient kings realized that if they just let the debts compound indefinitely, independent farmers would lose their land to wealthy creditors. They would fall into debt peonage, becoming essentially slaves to their lenders.
Which is obviously bad for the farmers, but why did the kings care?
Well, if that happened, the king would lose his tax base. He would lose his infantry for the army, and the entire social base of the civilization would collapse. The society would literally tear itself apart from the inequality.
So to prevent the parasite from killing the host, what did they do?
They instituted jubilees, or clean slates, periodic, widespread, legally mandated debt remissions.
Just wiping the ledger clean, just like that.
Yes. The new king would take the throne, declare a jubilee, cancel the agrarian debts, free the debt servants, and return the land to its original cultivators. And it is crucial to understand that this was not done out of altruism or charity.
It wasn't just them being nice.
Not at all. It was a social immune response. It was a highly calculated macroeconomic policy designed to prevent the destruction of the society's productive base. They understood a fundamental truth that we have forgotten.
Which is?
If financial claims exceed the life capacity of the community, insisting on full repayment is what actually causes disorder and collapse. Canceling the unpayable debt is what restores order in the living field.
Man, that completely upends the modern morality tale around debt.
Yeah.
Today, we treat repayment as this sacred, unbreakable moral duty.
Oh, absolutely.
If you take out a loan, you pay it back, period. It's framed as a measure of your personal character.
The paper identifies this exact phenomenon as the creditor's illusion. It's the deeply ingrained belief that enforceable claims can and must grow independently of the life required to satisfy them. But notice the glaring structural hypocrisy in how this illusion is applied in the modern era.
Hypocrisy how?
Well, when massive corporations, hedge funds, or major banks overextend themselves and face collapse, the system suddenly remembers how to be flexible. It remembers the logic of the Jubilee.
Oh, right. Bailouts.
Exactly. Those entities get Chapter 11 bankruptcies, massive central bank bailouts, quantitative easing, liquidity support, and comprehensive debt restructuring. The system recognizes that their failure would cause too much systemic damage, so the rules are suspended.
But the rules are never suspended for the individual.
Almost never.
If a student has an absolutely crushing loan, they can't pay because the entry-level job market collapsed, or a family is saddled with six-figure medical debt, or, you know, a small climate-vulnerable nation in the global south is drowning in external sovereign debt because a hurricane wiped out their infrastructure.
Suddenly, the system points to the fine print.
Yeah. You sign the contract, you must pay.
That is the essence of structural violence. The moralization of debt only seems to flow downward. Vulnerable communities are disciplined by brutal austerity programs told that repayment is a sacred duty, requiring them to gut their healthcare and education systems, while those at the top receive the modern equivalent of a clean slate.
It's just wild.
If we connect this back to Dr. Sakely's core diagnostic, a life-coherent system would operate on the principle that no financial claim is legitimate if enforcing it destroys the life capacity of the debtor.
Okay, so if debt has this incredible power to literally capture the future, to demand future labor and future resources, and to dictate whether a country builds a hospital or pays a foreign bondholder, the next logical question is, who has the power to create that debt in the first place?
Right, and that takes us inside the local commercial bank.
This is where it gets really interesting, because most of us operate under what economists call the intermediation myth of banking.
Yes, this is a crucial pivot in our understanding of the operating system. We assume that banks are essentially neutral middlemen. We think that savers deposit their money into a vault, and then the bank turns around and lends that exact same pool of money out to a borrower.
I think 99% of people believe that. I know I did. You put your paycheck in, the bank holds onto a little bit of it in reserve and lends the rest to the person buying a house down the street. It's the classic Jimmy Stewart and Prazit McKate. It's a wonderful life explanation.
Exactly, the Jimmy Stewart model. It is a very comforting narrative. But according to empirical research, particularly Richard Werner's credit creation theories, which the paper leans on, it is factually incorrect. Banks do not lend out pre-existing savings.
Wait, really? They don't?
No. Commercial banking does not work via intermediation. It works via creation. When a commercial bank extends a loan, say, for a mortgage or a business expansion, it creates new purchasing power out of thin air.
Out of thin air.
It expands its balance sheet. It creates a new asset for itself, which is the borrower's promissory note, and simultaneously creates a new liability, which is the deposit credited to the borrower's account. Mm-hmm. In that specific moment of typing numbers into a computer ledger, new money is born into the economy.
So they aren't moving existing money from point A to point B. They are literally expanding the total supply of money. The bank just invents the purchasing power.
Essentially, yes. They create balance sheet money. And this is why the banking sector wields such immense, almost sovereign power. The philosopher Humberto Maturana coined a brilliant concept for this, which the paper uses. He calls it world bringing.
World bringing. I love that term.
Because banks are creating new purchasing power, they are not just passively funding a world that already exists. They are actively choosing which specific futures get to materialize.
Because whoever gets that newly created money gets to go out into the real world, command concrete, steel, labor, and energy, and actually build their specific vision of the future. The bank is the gatekeeper of reality.
Exactly. If a bank creates credit to build a wind farm, a community clinic, or a high-speed rail line, it is bringing forth one type of world. If it creates credit to fund a leveraged buyout that loads a productive company with debt just to extract a dividend for private equity owners, it is bringing forth a very different, much more fragile world.
So to analyze this, the paper categorizes credit into three distinct types, right?
Yeah.
Based on their relationship to life capacity.
Yes, three types.
I'm guessing the wind farm and the leveraged buyout don't fall into the same category.
They absolutely do not. The first category is productive credit. This is credit that expands the real physical capacity of society. It funds goods, services, infrastructure, care work, and renewable energy. It builds the ability of a community to sustain life and absorb shocks.
Okay, so the new money is balanced by the creation of new real-world value. That makes sense. What's the second?
Second, there is speculative credit. This finances the purchase of existing assets. Think about a bank extending a massive loan to someone bidding up the price of a house that has already been built 50 years ago.
Right.
The loan doesn't create a new house. It doesn't improve the plumbing or fix the roof. It simply inflates the price of the existing asset.
So the asset itself doesn't get any better. It just gets drastically more expensive for the next person trying to buy it. You're just funding a bidding war.
Precisely. And this is a massive driver of the housing affordability crises we see globally. The banking sector realizes it is far safer and more profitable to lend against existing collateral, like urban real estate, than to fund a risky new productive enterprise.
Wow. And the third type?
The third category is extractive credit. This funds activities that generate cash flows by actively degrading life capacity. This is predatory payday lending, destructive fossil fuel extraction, or the financial engineering we just mentioned, where a healthy company is hollowed out, its assets sold off, its workers fired, all to service the debt taken on by the very people who bought it.
So this is where I have to pause and ask what seems to be the glaring question here.
Sure. What is it?
If commercial banks have this incredible public license to literally create the money supply, and let's be clear, it is a public license because the second these banks overextend themselves and face insolvency, the public central banks immediately step in to bail them out. Why on earth are their lending decisions based entirely on private short-term profit rather than the public good? Why do we allow private entities to steer the ship of world bringing?
It is perhaps the core contradiction of modern macroeconomic design. Banks operate a public monetary franchise for private gain. When the power of credit allocation is left entirely to the pursuit of private yield, the system inevitably becomes blind to anything that isn't highly monetizable in the short term.
So it just chases the fastest buck.
Exactly. The internal logic of the system dictates that it will fund speculative real estate over affordable housing because the yield is higher and the collateral is safer. It will fund fossil fuel expansion over ecological repair because the repair of a watershed doesn't generate a fast enough quarterly cash flow to service a commercial loan.
We are essentially trusting a profit-maximizing algorithm to design our civilization. It's nuts. So what is the alternative? How do we fix a fundamental design flaw like that?
The paper points heavily toward concepts like public banking and credit guidance. What if we treated the creation of credit not as a private right, but as a critical public utility?
A public utility.
Yes. Imagine a system where society democratically directs a portion of newly created credit toward its actual physical needs. We could establish public investment banks tasked specifically with funding ecological repair, affordable housing, and public health infrastructure at zero or negative real interest rates.
That would be huge.
We could use credit guidance regulations to restrict the amount of speculative credit private banks are allowed to issue against existing real estate, cooling the housing market and forcing capital back into productive enterprise.
So instead of letting private banks passively inflate massive asset bubbles, we actually grab the steering wheel and guide the credit toward what the society physically requires to survive and flourish. It's taking back the power of world bringing.
Precisely.
But the moment you suggest the government should fund massive public works, we run straight into another massive macroeconomic misconception. We're constantly told that the government, which literally issues the national currency, is somehow broke or running out of money.
Ah, yes. The infamous household budget analogy. It is arguably the most destructive economic myth in political discourse today.
Every politician loves it. They stand at a podium and say, just like a hardworking family sitting around the kitchen table, the federal government has to balance its checkbook. We cannot spend money we do not have. We have to tighten our belts.
And this is where the framework of modern monetary theory, or MMT, completely dismantles the conventional wisdom. A currency-issuing state like the U.S., the U.K., or Japan is absolutely nothing like a household.
Nothing like it.
A household is a currency user. It must earn income or borrow money from a bank before it can spend. A monetarily sovereign state is a currency issuer. It does the exact opposite. It spends its currency into existence.
Wait, spends it into existence?
Yes. When the government wants to build a bridge, it doesn't wait for tax receipts to arrive in a vault. It instructs the central bank to credit the bank accounts of the construction companies. It types the money into existence. It does not need to tax first in order to spend.
The analogy I've always loved for this is the casino. Treating the national budget like a household budget is like a casino owner sweating and pacing the floor, terrified that they're going to run out of poker chips.
That is an excellent way to visualize it.
The constraint on the casino isn't the plastic chips. They can order millions of them. The constraint is the actual physical size of the building, the number of tables they have, and the number of dealers they can hire.
Right. The currency, the chips are just the accounting units. They are the scorekeeping mechanism. But this realization inevitably triggers immediate resistance from people.
Oh, for sure.
People say, if the government can just print money to fund whatever it wants, why don't they just print $1 million for everyone? Wouldn't that cause massive inflation? And if they don't need my money, why on earth do I have to pay taxes?
Exactly. If the state isn't constrained by revenue, what is the point of the IRS? Why tax me at all?
Well, the paper frames taxation not as revenue collection in the household sense, but as structured reciprocity and macroeconomic management. Taxes serve several absolutely critical functions in a sovereign system.
Okay, let's go through them.
First, and most fundamentally, taxes create the baseline demand for the fiat currency. If the government demands that your property taxes be paid in its specific currency, you are forced to go out and obtain that currency. That is what gives the money its value and acceptance.
Ah, the tax creates the demand for the token.
Exactly. Second, taxes are the primary tool to manage inflation. If the government spends too much money into an economy that is already at full productive capacity, prices will rise. Taxation acts as a release valve, withdrawing purchasing power from the private sector to cool the economy down.
So you don't tax to fund the bridge?
No. You tax to ensure that when the government buys the concrete for the bridge, it isn't competing with the private sector and driving up the price of concrete. Third, taxes are used to reduce harmful, destabilizing wealth inequality and curb rent extraction. And fourth, they serve a moral purpose, reconnecting private wealth accumulation to the civil commons. The roads, the educated workforce, the legal system that made that wealth possible in the first place.
So taxes aren't about finding the money to pay for things. They are a tool for managing the physical economy, preventing inflation, and maintaining the social fabric. And when you realize that, the entire mainstream narrative around austerity completely collapses.
It shatters completely. We are constantly subjected to austerity narratives. We are told we must aggressively cut funding for public health, public education, and critical infrastructure to, you know, save money and be fiscally responsible.
Right.
But if the government isn't physically constrained by money, cutting those programs isn't saving anything. It is actively destroying the life capacity of the nation. It is degrading the physical and intellectual infrastructure that future prosperity relies on.
Because the real wealth of a nation isn't the spreadsheet balance of the treasury. It's the physical health of its people, the education level of its kids, the resilience of its power grid, the stability of its environment.
Exactly. And the analytical framework goes even deeper. The economist Wynne Godley developed a concept known as sectoral balances. It is a fundamental accounting identity that proves that in a closed monetary economy, one sector's deficit is, by absolute mathematical definition, another sector's surplus.
Wait, walk me through that. Godley sectoral balances. How does that math work?
Imagine the economy is divided into two main sectors, the government sector and the non-government sector. The non-government sector includes domestic households and businesses. Every dollar the government spends is a dollar that goes into the non-government sector's pockets. Every dollar the government taxes is a dollar taken out of those pockets.
Okay, I'm following.
These four, if the government runs a deficit, meaning it spends more than it taxes, that exact amount of money accumulates as a surplus in the non-government sector. The government's red ink is the private sector's black ink.
Oh, wow. So when politicians stand up
and brag that they were going to run a budget surplus and pay down the national debt.
Yeah.
What they're actually saying is that they're going to tax more money out of the economy than they put in.
Yes.
They are mathematically forcing the private sector into a deficit. They are draining our bank accounts to pad the government's ledger.
Yes, that's exactly what it means. When the government aggressively tightens its belt to balance the budget, households and businesses are structurally starved of financial assets. To maintain their standard of living or keep their businesses afloat, they often have to turn to private banks and take on immense amounts of private debt.
So the debt doesn't go away.
The financial burden doesn't disappear, no. It just gets transferred from the public ledger, which can handle it endlessly, to the household ledger, which is fragile and prone to bankruptcy.
Man, that is eye-opening. So if we stop obsessing over the financial deficit, what should we be focusing on?
We must shift to real resource budgeting. The true limits of a nation's economy are not accounting numbers. The limits are real. Ecological thresholds, the availability of skilled labor, energy capacity, and physical materials.
Physical stuff.
Right. If a society has idle construction workers, idle heavy equipment, and a desperate unmet social need like building a seawall to protect a coastal city or transitioning a power grid to renewables, claiming that the society doesn't have the money to connect those idle workers to that urgent need, is a tragic self-imposed illusion.
It's just a failure of imagination.
A life-coherent society evaluates public investment not by the financial cost on a spreadsheet, but by evaluating whether the physical resources exist and whether the investment builds future life capacity.
But let me play devil's advocate here for a second.
Sure, go ahead.
If real resources are our only true limits, and we have incredible technological capacity to harvest those resources, why does our financial system constantly push us into chaotic economic crises? I mean, we have plenty of food, plenty of skilled labor, plenty of building materials, yet every decade or so, the entire global economy seems to implode.
Right.
The paper argues that this instability is actually driven by a dangerous obsession with efficiency, which sounds a little backwards to me.
It is a profound insight, and to explore it, the paper integrates the work of the economist Hyman Minsky, specifically his financial instability hypothesis. Minsky's core thesis is deeply counterintuitive, but historically flawless. He says that stability breeds instability.
That sounds like a paradox. How does economic stability create a crisis?
Think about the psychological mechanics of a long period of economic calm. Let's say it's been 10 years since the last recession. Asset prices are rising steadily, unemployment is low, corporate profits are strong. Because there haven't been any recent shocks, the memory of fear fades.
People get comfortable.
Yes. Banks start to feel incredibly confident, so they lower their lending standards to capture more market share. Borrowers, seeing that their assets are appreciating, feel confident too, so they decide to take on more leverage to maximize their returns. Minsky categorized this gradual drift into risk through three distinct stages: hedge finance, speculative finance, and Ponzi finance.
Okay, walk me through that timeline. Let's imagine a real estate investor over a 10-year boom.
Sure. In the first stage, hedge finance, the system is conservative. Our investor buys an apartment building. The rental income from the building is more than enough to pay back both the principal and the interest on the loan. It's safe, resilient, and can withstand a slight dip in rents.
Makes sense.
But as confidence grows and prices rise, the investor wants to expand faster. We move into speculative finance. Here, the investor takes on much more debt. The rental income is now only enough to cover the interest payments. It cannot pay down the principal. The investor is reliant on constantly rolling over or refinancing the principal when the loan comes due.
Like an interest-only mortgage. You're just treading water, assuming the bank will always be there to refinance you.
Exactly. And finally, driven by greed and the fear of missing out, the system drifts into Ponzi finance. In this stage, the investor takes on so much debt that the rental income isn't even enough to cover the interest payments. The enterprise is bleeding cash every single month.
Wait, then how do they survive?
The only way the investor survives is by taking on even more debt to pay the old debt, or by banking entirely on the apartment building constantly going up in price so they can eventually sell it to someone else at a massive profit.
So the underlying productive value of the asset, the actual rents, becomes totally irrelevant. The whole system becomes entirely dependent on the asset price going up forever.
Yes.
And the moment the music stops, the moment prices just plateaus, let alone fall, the Ponzi borrower defaults, the bank takes a hit, they pull back lending, the speculative borrower can't refinance, and the whole house of cards collapses.
That is the Minsky moment. And what happens during this long drift toward Ponzi finance is that the financial system systematically strips away something absolutely vital to human survival. Margin.
Margin, like having a buffer or a safety net.
Yes. Margin is the spare capacity in a system. Margin is a hospital maintaining 50 empty beds and a stockpile of ventilators just in case. It's a household having 6 months of emergency savings. It's a global supply chain having backup inventory stored in local warehouses. It's an ecosystem having rich biodiversity and deep topsoil to withstand a multi-year drought.
Okay, I see.
But modern finance views margin as a sin. It views it as inefficient capital. If a hospital bed is empty, it's not generating daily revenue. If a company has a massive cash reserve, activist hedge funds will launch a hostile takeover, demanding they use that cash for stock buybacks to pump the share price.
But wait, I'm going to push back here, arguing the mainstream economic view. Isn't efficiency a good thing? When a supply chain uses just-in-time manufacturing to eliminate warehousing costs, those savings get passed down to me.
In theory, yeah.
If a hospital keeps 50 empty beds, their overhead is huge, and my medical bills skyrocket. Isn't the market just relentlessly giving us the low prices and optimized systems we demand? Waste is bad, right?
This is what we call the efficiency trap. Being maximally lean and perfectly efficient is fantastic for extracting maximum profit, and yes, sometimes lowering immediate consumer costs during normal calm times, but eliminating all your margin guarantees a catastrophic systemic collapse the moment an unpredictable disturbance arrives.
So it's a trade-off.
To use a mechanical metaphor, think of the crumple zone on a car. A crumple zone is incredibly inefficient space. It makes the car heavier, it consumes fuel, and it takes up room that could be used for cargo. But when you hit a wall at 60 miles an hour, that inefficient margin is the only thing that saves your life.
Oh, man. That's a brilliant way to look at it. What finance calls efficiency, living systems call fragility.
Exactly. A hospital running at 100% efficiency with perfectly optimized staffing and no spare beds is a highly profitable enterprise right up until a pandemic hits. Then the lack of margin costs thousands of lives.
Or the supply chain.
Right. The global semiconductor supply chain was perfectly, beautifully efficient right up until a single ship got stuck in the Suez Canal and suddenly car factories across the globe had to shut down. This is why Minsky and Dr. Sahali argue that a financial crisis is not just a disaster, it is actually a revelation.
A revelation of what?
It strips away the ideological facade of the hyper-efficient free market and reveals the structural truth. The highly leveraged, marginless private sector cannot survive its own inevitable shocks. When the crisis hits, it suddenly desperately relies on the ultimate margin, the public sector.
The bailouts again?
It requires massive government bailouts, central bank intervention, and public stimulus to survive. The system privatizes the gains during the boom, extracting all the margin for shareholders, and socializes the massive losses during the bust.
And this relentless structural drive to eliminate margin in favor of short-term profit leads us directly to what the paper calls the core pathology of modern civilization, which brings us to the concept of financialization.
Yes. To deeply understand financialization, the paper relies heavily on the Canadian philosopher John McMurtry. McMurtry identifies two opposing fundamental logics of value in the world, the life sequence and the money sequence.
Okay, let's look at how those sequences work.
In a healthy, life-coherent society, you operate under the life sequence. In this sequence, money is properly subjugated as a tool to facilitate life. The sequence is life produce money, which is used to produce more life. You use your human energy to acquire money, and you use that money to build a clinic, buy nutritious food, or educate a child so that life can flourish.
That makes total sense. Money is the servant. It is a means to an end, and the end is human well-being.
But financialization causes what McMurtry calls a great inversion. It flips the sequence entirely. We move to the money sequence, and the formula becomes money produces life, which is exploited to produce more money. In this inverted reality, life is no longer the goal. Life becomes merely an input, a raw material, a cost center to be minimized in order to grow financial claims. Money becomes the absolute master, and its self-multiplication becomes the sole purpose of the economy.
So under the money sequence, you don't build a hospital to heal the sick. You build a hospital because sick people are a captive revenue stream that can generate a 15% annualized return for a healthcare real estate investment trust. The healing is just an accidental byproduct of the yield extraction.
That is exactly the distinction, and this connects directly to the sociologist Johann Galtung's theory of structural violence. We usually think of violence as a direct physical act, someone physically assaulting someone else. But Galtung argues that violence can be embedded silently into the very structure of society.
Like systemic harm.
Yes. If a financialized real estate market turns housing primarily into a yield-generating asset class, driving up rents so aggressively that families face eviction, displacement, and homelessness, that is violence. It causes measurable, profound bodily and psychological harm, even if it's perfectly legal, totally bloodless, and looks like an ordinary, efficient market outcome.
Because enforcing scarcity on a basic biological human need, like shelter or medicine, in order to generate a profit for an investor who already has shelter, is a structurally violent act against the person who requires that resource to survive.
Yes, and we can see the devastating effects of this inversion when we look at how the financial system treats nature and care work.
Care work is a great example.
Right, care work, raising children, caring for the elderly, maintaining a household, community building is the absolute bedrock foundation of human survival and societal reproduction. If it stops, society collapses in a week. But under the logic of the money sequence, care work is structurally invisible.
Because it's not monetized.
Because it is largely unpaid and doesn't generate a financial yield or trade on an exchange, the system assigns it a value of zero.
It literally doesn't compute. The most important work in the world is treated as economically worthless.
Exactly. And the exact same logic applies to the natural world.
Mm.
A pristine, old-growth forest is ignored by the financial system unless it can be chopped down and sold for timber, or perhaps priced as natural capital and sold as carbon offsets to a polluting corporation.
The living ecosystem doesn't matter.
The intrinsic life value of the forest, its role in the hydrological cycle, its biodiversity, is totally invisible. Only its monetizable extraction value registers on the ledger.
And we are seeing this inversion aggressively penetrate every sector of society now.
Mm.
You look at private equity firms buying up chains of nursing homes or veterinary clinics. They acquire the business, load it with debt, hollow out the staffing to cut costs, and the quality of care absolutely plummets. The margin is stripped away to pay the debt service.
And that leads to one of the most tragic, almost dystopian ironies of financialization, which Dr. Safely highlights. It's the role of pension funds.
Pension funds. How so?
Think about the mechanics of a modern worker's retirement. Ordinary teachers, firefighters, and factory workers put their deferred wages into massive, multi-billion dollar pension funds. Those funds are desperate to meet their 7% or 8% annual yield targets to remain solvent.
Yep, because they have to pay out future retirements.
Right. To get those returns in a low-growth environment, the pension funds allocate capital to aggressive private equity and hedge funds. Those exact funds then go out into the real economy, buy up the companies where those people work, suppress their wages, fire their colleagues, and buy up the housing stock in their neighborhoods, raising their rent.
It's a closed loop of self-cannibalization. The workers are literally forced by the architecture of the system to invest in the very financial vehicles that are actively making their present daily lives unaffordable and precarious.
Hmm.
They are funding their own structural violence.
It is incredibly bleak, but recognizing the mechanism is the first step, which leads us to a critical question. If this inverted system is so clearly destructive to human life and ecological stability, how does it protect itself? Why does society tolerate it?
Yeah, why do we put up with it?
And the answer lies in the architecture of the law.
This is fascinating. We tend to think of finance and law as two completely different spheres.
Mm.
But you're saying the law is the defensive shield for the money sequence.
Yes. To understand this, the paper draws on the work of legal scholar Katharina Pastor and her brilliant concept of the legal coding of capital. We have this naive assumption that an asset, like a piece of land, an idea, or a debt contract, is just naturally capital. But Pister proves that assets don't magically become capital. They have to be actively coded into capital by teams of specialized lawyers and lawmakers.
Coded, like a software developer writing a program.
Exactly like software, but using legal modules instead of Python or C++ Word. Lawyers use modules like property rights, collateral rules, trust law, bankruptcy priorities, and corporate law. These legal codes are what give ordinary assets their superpowers.
Superpowers like what?
Priority, durability, universality, and most importantly, the ability to mobilize state violence, the police, and the courts to enforce the claim.
Let's talk about the most pervasive legal module of all, the corporation itself. Because the paper describes the corporate form as both a vessel and a shield.
A corporation is, in many ways, an ingenious legal vessel. It allows for the pooling of vast amounts of resources and the organization of complex, multi-generational, productive work. But its true power lies in its function as a legal shield.
The limited liability aspect.
Yes, the core module is limited liability. This legal fiction dictates that the owners, the shareholders, can extract massive, unlimited profits from a company. But if that company takes massive risks and causes catastrophic environmental damage or sells a dangerous product that harms thousands, the owner's personal assets are entirely shielded from liability.
So they get all the upside, but none of the true downside.
Exactly. The legal code allows capital to privatize the upside indefinitely while legally externalizing the downside onto the public or the environment.
It's an asymmetric risk profile engineered by law. And we see this legal coding explicitly in bankruptcy, too. You touched on this earlier when we talked about the creditor's illusion. When a massive company actually does go under, who gets paid first?
Pister points out that the bankruptcy code is not just a financial document. It is a profound moral document. It legally dictates whose life matters most. In corporate bankruptcy, secured financial creditors, the massive banks and bondholders who coded the debt, always get paid first. They are at the absolute top of the capital structure.
And what about everyone else?
The workers who lost their pensions, the communities left with toxic environmental cleanup costs, the small suppliers who weren't paid to dice, they are treated as unsecured residual afterthoughts. The law is structurally designed to prioritize the claim power of abstracted money over the physical life capacity of human beings.
And if the laws in one specific country actually try to push back, say a democratic government tries to raise taxes on corporations or enforce strict environmental liabilities, the capital simply uses another legal module to escape. Let's talk about offshore finance.
Offshore finance is the ultimate expression of capital escaping social reciprocity. A multinational corporation might extract immense value from the public infrastructure, the publicly educated workforce, the legal stability, and the consumer base of a specific country, say the United States or the UK.
Right.
But through a labyrinth of shell companies, trust structures, and jurisdictional arbitrage, it legally relocates its intellectual property and its massive profits to a secrecy jurisdiction, a tax haven like the Cayman Islands or Ireland.
So they happily use the roads, the police force, and the educated workers of a real physical place to generate their wealth, but then hide that wealth in a filing cabinet on a tropical island specifically to avoid paying the taxes required to maintain those roads and schools.
Yes. It severs the feedback loop. It breaks the fundamental social contract. Capital extracts nourishment from the life ground, but legally refuses to replenish it.
So here is my ultimate question on this. Mm-hmm. If the rules of the game are so clearly rigged by corporate lawyers to favor claim power over life capacity, why can't democratic governments just step in and close the loopholes? We elect the lawmakers. We ostensibly control the state. Why don't they just change the legal code?
Because of a phenomenon the paper describes as the de-risking state. The political process itself has been fundamentally captured by the logic of financialization.
What does that mean in practice?
Public policy in most Western democracies is no longer primarily organized around provisioning for the public good or protecting citizens from market failures. The state's primary function has shifted. It is now organized around protecting investor confidence, maintaining asset values, and ensuring that the national jurisdiction remains competitive for highly mobile global capital.
The state becomes terrified of the market.
Exactly. If a government tries to aggressively close tax loopholes or implement strict rent control or heavily regulate carbon emissions, capital threatens a capital strike. It threatens to sell off the nation's bonds, crash the currency, or relocate its headquarters.
And the politicians cave.
The state, terrified of this market punishment, capitulates. It actively works to de-risk investments for private capital through subsidies, guarantees, and bailouts rather than de-risking life for its citizens. The state is repurposed as a bodyguard for the money sequence.
Wow. The state as a bodyguard for the money sequence. That is a chilling realization. And it becomes even more urgent when we realize that we are currently right in the middle of a massive, epoch-defining technological upgrade to this entire legal and financial rulebook.
Yes, the digital shift.
The system is moving from paper and legal code to literal computer code. This is the digital fork in the road. And the path we choose over the next decade is going to define the future of human freedom.
We are entering the era of digital money. Central bank digital currencies, or CBDCs, corporate stablecoins, programmable money, and algorithmic finance. Dr. Sakely stresses the profound dual nature of this technological leap. It is a true crossroads.
Correct, because the technology itself isn't inherently evil. It could theoretically go one of two ways.
Precisely. On one path, digital money could be engineered as a democratic, resilient, privacy-respecting public infrastructure. A properly designed CBDC could provide every citizen with a free, secure public bank account.
Like a postal banking model.
Right. It could completely eliminate the parasitic fees charged by private payment processors. It could expand access to the unbanked and allow for instant, direct public provisioning like disaster relief or universal basic income without private banks taking a cut or slowing it down.
It could be a true public utility, like the highway system, but for money.
Yes. But on the other path, the path we are currently drifting toward it, could become the ultimate inescapable tool for what the paper calls programmable command.
And this ties directly into the financialization of human behavior, right?
Right.
Surveillance capitalism merging with the money supply.
Exactly. We already live in a world where digital platforms turn almost every human action, what you buy, where you travel, what you read, who you interact with, into commodified data. If that data architecture is linked directly to your programmable digital money, the potential for structural violence becomes absolute.
It just bakes it right in.
It enables pervasive algorithmic credit scoring. It allows for behavioral nudging and continuous granular surveillance of the population.
Because if your money is programmable, it isn't just a neutral unit of account anymore. The issuer can attach conditions to it.
Yes, negative conditionality. Programmable money could be coded to expire if you don't spend it fast enough, forcing consumption to stimulate the economy. It could be restricted from certain geographic areas or restricted from purchasing specific goods like plane tickets or red meat based on a carbon footprint algorithm or a social credit score. It gives the issuer the power to literally code what futures you are allowed to participate in.
So financial inclusion into this specific type of digital system without massive, unbreakable privacy safeguards isn't liberation. It's just inclusion into a digital panopticon.
Mm-hmm.
You're being banked, but you're living inside a surveillance machine.
That's the danger.
But wait, let me bring in the crypto perspective here. Advocates for Bitcoin and decentralized finance, or DeFi, argue that they are solving this exact problem. They say they're decentralizing finance, taking the ledger away from the coercive state and the predatory big banks and giving it back to the people. Isn't crypto the antidote to the programmable command of the state?
The paper is highly critical of the crypto narrative and specifically dismantles the foundational myth of trustlessness. Crypto advocates claim to replace fragile human trust and corruptible institutions with pure objective code. But in reality, observing the crypto ecosystem over the last decade, it hasn't dismantled the money sequence. It has hyper-accelerated it.
How so?
It frequently just creates new, unregulated forms of speculative enclosure.
What do you mean by speculative enclosure?
Look at the mechanics of decentralized finance. It doesn't fund productive capacity. It introduces massive, automated, instantaneous leverage. It relies on a new class of private actors, crypto exchanges, stablecoin issuers, venture capitalists, extracting tolls and rents at every step.
So it's the same middleman problem, just different middlemen.
Yes. It attempts to turn literally every human interaction and digital asset into a hyper-financialized, tradable token. And most importantly, returning to our diagnostic question, it is almost completely divorced from real-world life capacity.
Right. Yield farming a governance token doesn't build affordable housing. It doesn't heal the sick. It requires massive amounts of energy to run proof-of-work consensus, but it doesn't feed anybody.
Exactly. It creates massive self-referential loops of digital speculation that occasionally crash and wipe out retail investors. It is not an escape from financialization. It is financialization stripped of any remaining pretense of serving the real economy. It is the money sequence operating in a purely abstract void.
Okay, we have covered an incredible amount of intellectual territory today. We've traced a drift of finance from ancient face-to-face village ledgers of social memory through the temporal traps of compound interest to the immense world-bringing power of private banks.
Yeah.
We've dismantled the household budget myth, explored the fragility of hyper-efficiency, and seen how the legal code actively protects the money sequence all the way up to the looming threat of programmable digital extraction.
We really have. It's a lot to process.
We've seen exactly how the operating system got corrupted. So, for our final act, how do we pull the emergency mic? How do we actually begin to rebuild a life-coherent financial system?
It has to start with applying Dr. Sally's ultimate diagnostic test to absolutely every aspect of the economy. We have to embed a new source code into the system. Here is the principle. No financial claim is legitimate beyond the life capacity of the persons, communities, ecosystems, and future generations required to honor it.
That is profound. If a financial claim requires the destruction of human life or ecological viability to be paid, the claim itself is illegitimate and must be dissolved, period.
Yes. And from that foundational principle, the repair pathways become much clearer. First, we need to restructure banking. We must evaluate credit creation based on what it physically builds in the real world, its contribution to life capacity, not just its financial yield.
We have to steer the world bringing.
Second, we need to resurrect the wisdom of the ancients and utilize massive debt relief and jubilees as a regular, necessary social immune response to prevent systemic collapse, not frame them as a rare, controversial act of charity.
We have to forgive the debt to save the host.
Third, we must shift from financial accounting to real resource, ecological budgeting that fundamentally respects planetary boundaries. Fourth, we must use legal coding to aggressively protect essential human needs like housing and healthcare from speculative investment so that homes remain shelters, not poker chips for global capital.
And the digital side.
Finally, as we move into the digital era, we must strictly design digital money as a fundamental privacy-protected public right, permanently outlawing programmable negative conditionality.
So why should you, the listener, care about all this complex macroeconomic and legal theory? Because this is fundamentally about your daily agency. It is about recognizing that the crushing rules of money are not immutable laws of physics. They are not gravity. They are choices. They are lines of code written by lawyers, maintained by politicians, and enforced by institutions.
That's the most empowering part of all this.
And because they were constructed by people, they can be deconstructed and rewritten by people. We have to stop accepting the artificial scarcity imposed upon us and demand a financial architecture that serves life, not just yield.
And that realization brings us to one final, deeply profound concept from Dr. Sekely's paper that we haven't touched on yet, and it's where I'd like to leave the listener. It is the concept of the psychological toll of financial trauma.
Financial trauma. I think a lot of people are going to resonate with that term.
Yes. I want you to sit with this thought. Think about the chronic, low-grade anxiety, the deep-seated shame, and the pervasive fear you might feel when you think about money, about your debts, about your sheer ability to survive and provide in this economy. Every single day, the culture tells us that this anxiety is a personal feeling.
It's always your fault.
We are told we just lack financial literacy, or we didn't budget our spreadsheets well enough, or we lack the discipline to skip that cup of coffee.
We internalize the systemic failure as a personal character flaw.
Exactly. But what if your anxiety is not a personal failure at all? What if your anxiety is a perfectly rational, highly attuned biological response to living inside a structurally violent system that is actively mathematically designed to consume your margin? What if your body is simply registering the threat of a system that views your life merely as collateral?
That completely shifts the burden. Healing our relationship with money might not start with downloading a better personal budgeting app or reading another self-help book on hustle culture. It might start with the radical realization that the operating system itself is sick, and you are not to blame.
The macroeconomic X-ray machine has been broken for a very long time, but by understanding these concepts, we are finally learning how to read the true diagnostic of life.
We started today by asking how checking your bank account makes you feel. Hopefully, the next time you look at that number on the screen, you won't just see a measure of your personal worth or a source of guilt. You will see a tiny, abstracted piece of a massive civilizational grammar. A grammar that is currently broken, but one that we absolutely have the power and the profound duty to rewrite.